You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Jennifer Dixon, who's just written a terrific book entitled The Holy Land Unveiled. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
I never thought that I could get more angry at Israel and Jews, but you did it. I go through my life reading as much as I do and learning about what this country does to the inhabitants there, the Palestinians, and what they do here in this country and how duplicitous they are, and everything seems to be about deception. And reading this book, like I told you before the interview, I didn't think I can get angrier, but I did it, and thank you. Because I guess the main thing that comes into my head after reading the book is that these people are heartless and cruel. Would that be an overstatement?
Not at all. When I wrote this book, and I went there, I was shocked and fearful. And at the same time, I had this like pressure that I put on myself, thinking you have to be so exact and clear and try to convey it fairly, and you're going to get attacked. So it's this whole horrendous thing you kind of carry around. And of course, it is about the duplicity because, I mean, the story we've been told is 180 degrees the opposite of what the reality is.
Right. And I wanted to ask you, because right in the beginning of the book, you talk about when you were there. You were there at Christmas time in 1989 to 1990. And then you were there again in 2005, and you were there again in 2009.
Right.
And each time you were there, the conditions that the Palestinians were living under got progressively worse, right?
Incredibly. When I was there in 89-90, Christmas time, in Bethlehem, and we spent it under curfew inside with the tanks surrounding Bethlehem Square outside the Nativity Church because, well, we were in a war zone. That was bad enough. That was the first intifada. Could see the extreme poverty of people there. But I wasn't really too wise about it. I didn't quite get it. I mean, I saw it superficially. And I came back and I wrote some letters, tried to get them published, and it never happened, of course. Then I went back. I worked in Washington at places that were left-wing think tanks, in fact. And they were anti-war, presumably. But they left this out. And that was a striking thing, or they undercovered it. And that's another kind of game, deception game. So I saw what I saw in 2005. By that time, I was more kind of mentally armed, and I was careful about noticing details and going into certain aspects of the situation. And then by the time I went back in 2009, it just blew me away because I was in an outdoor prison.
Why did you go initially in 89-90? Was there a particular reason that you went?
I was on a tour. I was on a Holy Land tour.
Like a vacation?
Essentially.
And then why did you go back in 2005?
Because I had seen things that didn't gel with what we were told here. So I kind of kept it in my mind to go back. And of course, it was years later when I finally did it. They try very hard to brainwash the American public. And the people that go there, the tourists, they lead them away. They're inculcating them with this anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian attitude. They're all terrorists. Stay out of shops. Don't give them any money. Better be careful. But when you talk to them, you realize these are nice people who are suffering. But that was one side of it. By the time I went back in 2005, I really saw on the ground what was happening to these people.
So you went back 15 years later because your curiosity was piqued by what you were not being told in the mainstream media?
In 2005, we were 15 years into war in the Middle East heavy. And I was part of the peace movement in 1990-91 against the war in Iraq. You know, I had really tuned into things in those 15 years. You know, I had started to wake up and turn off the news. I worked for some people in D.C. that were kind of bogus, the so-called peace movement. That was very weak. But as I learned more and more, I wanted to learn more and more. And I wanted to see it. I mean, really see it. Not see it from a tour bus.
Right. Or behind a keyboard. And what about 2009? Why'd you go back there then?
I actually got invited back to work for a small little press out there. I don't want to talk about them because, you know, it endangers anybody you're connected to out there. The names of the books are fakes anyway, of course, because I could dare expose these people. But I wanted to tell their story. So anyway, I went back in 2009. And also between 2005 and 2009 is when they just finished the wall, if it ever will be finished, and it created this horrific police state. I mean, right. We talk about police state here. You have no idea.
The wall is something that works its way in a literal and figurative sense through the entire book, and I want to touch on that also later on. But when you were there in 2009, I think that was the year that they committed those atrocities during their caste-led invasion, right?
It was actually Christmas before then. It was 2008, 2009 when they blew up Gaza.
Yeah, that Merry Christmas. Campaign.
Right. The Merry Christmas campaign, 1,500 killed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Civilians, mostly.
Civilians, mostly.
Children, women, right? They're very nice people. Besides the fact that the United States Congress is a slave to Israeli and Jewish money, and there's really no other way to explain that. Besides that fact, I think from being around this as long as I have and paying attention to it the way I have, I think there's something intrinsically and inherently evil and cruel with these people that they can do these things continually.
What is fascinating to me is the psychosis of it, because up till last week, 2 weeks ago, and they still are the victims.
Right.
This horrific campaign of rockets by Hamas, 500 rockets. Well, then compare the death tolls. 2 initially on the Israeli, but that was preceded by Palestinian dead by Israelis. You never told that. And then it turned into like 25 Israelis and 170 Palestinians.
That's fair.
So there you go. And it's always like that. But it stopped when the bus was blown up, supposedly by a terrorist campaign. And you never know, because it's all make-believe in American media. It's a fantasy. Americans live in a fantasy.
Absolutely. You're 100% unfortunately right. And who knows, like you said, they might have blown up their own bus. And
sure.
And it's been done before.
Of course. False flag operations.
That's it. And you brought that up in the book also when you were talking about this child who was going to be recruited into the ranks of Hamas to be a suicide bomber because one of his schoolmates was killed by the Israelis/Jews, that he was somehow uncovered by the Israeli authorities and he had only talked to, I guess, a couple of people. So maybe the whole thing with Hamas, and again, you interviewed one person who said that Hamas was created by Israel to further destroy the Palestinians. Who really knows what's going on? We don't.
Exactly. We don't even know what goes on in our own country.
Absolutely. It's worse than the Matrix.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Matrix is at least controlled.
Yeah, right.
this is out of control.
You got a lot of your information from a great site and a great person. You got it from ifamericansknew.org. And I've interviewed Allison Ware. One thing that is, again, woven throughout the book is the mainstream media. And I just want to ask you about that. Because you pointed out many times how the United States mainstream media wants to, they do, they paint a picture that, as you just mentioned, the Israelis/Jews are the victims and the Palestinians/Arabs are the perpetrators and are the terrorists. And although the numbers are clear, as you point out many times, that the numbers of Palestinians murdered by these Israelis/Jews is much, much higher than the reverse.
And, exactly.
Right. But however, the United States mainstream media presents the coverage in a fashion that it's 7, 10 times, 150% more covering the lone or sole Israeli death. Why?
Why do they do that? To perpetuate the situation? To keep the cash flowing?
We're in the U.S. Why would they do that for Israel?
The tie-in between the international Jewish community and their financial power in this country is so great, and they've interwoven themselves into the American government and our policies to support Israel, but more than that, to promote its growth. I mean, Israel's an expanding state. Israel doesn't have borders, and Israel continues to grow. When they were given, which is interesting in itself, the Palestinian mandate by the UN in 1948, they were given a little over half of that state. Well, they were only 30% of the population. And that 30% had only arrived in the previous 30 years. Actually, they were only 8% back in 1917 at the signing of the Balfour Declaration. And that's important because essentially the UN created an institute by those same bankers, as it turns out, gave this incoming population more of the country than the people who actually lived there and whose country it was. But now Israel controls 80% officially, but they actually control half of the West Bank, which they've chopped up into these little parcels of land controlled by the wall, controlled by the military. And that's one thing, but now Israel continues to grow. When I was there, one of the strangest things I saw was a map in a kid's school, pulled down a map in a school that had been invaded by the Israelis in 2000. And on that map, on the countries of Saudi Arabia and Egypt, the Israelis had drawn in English or had written in English and in Arabic the word Israel. So they are expanding. They're expanding economically. They're expanding militarily. Israel's one of the world's largest military. This is a nation of 7 million people. I mean, the military might of the United States is in itself insane. We spend 5 times what China spends, and China spends twice of what Russia spends, according to AFP. So why does this little country have this huge military to protect themselves against so-called terrorists?
Right. They're the terrorists to begin with.
They are. Mm-hmm. And they were initially.
Right. Absolutely. It's funny. I interviewed that former Navy SEAL who wrote one book, I think, about bin Laden. And he brought up that the person who invented the car bomb was an Israeli Jew. It was Menachem Begin.
Pitched to us as a peacenik.
Yeah.
Talking about false flag operations, you go back to the USS Liberty, you go back to the Lavan affair in Egypt, the King David Hotel. It's all Israeli false flag operations to get it off the ground. Get what off the ground? Perpetual war. What have we had in the Middle East since 1948? War. How many did Israelis start? All of them except one. In 73, Syria and Egypt tried to get their land back that the Israelis had stolen. But, of course, the Israelis are always the victims.
Menachem Begin. It's like I always envision somebody joking on matzah. Menachem Begin. No, really, Jennifer, you brought something out in me that should not have come out. No, I take that back. It should come out. We should develop our disgust for these people because they're filthy and they're horrible and they inflict pain on... See, you know what it is? This is what it is. I'll tell you what it is. It's the children.
Yeah, but it's a whole society. They just beat up on these people 24/7. Never stops. They blow up their homes. 150,000 Palestinian homes have been blown up by these people in the last 60 years. They rip up the olive trees. They shoot the kids in the head. They have targeted over 1,000 people in assassinations. They blow up apartment buildings to find one Hamas operative, kill hundreds of people.
And it's all in your book. I know, it's sick. You obviously went there, so you experienced it firsthand. There are very few people who have actually done that or can actually do that. I have actually been there myself.
Okay.
Back in the mid-80s, but I was even dumber than I am now. And I was on, you know, like a tour just like you, but, you know, being brought to certain areas and was for such a short period of time, I knew nothing anyway. But we know what we know now.
Right.
And there's plenty of people who know what we know, and there's some who know more, and there's some who know less, and there's some who know the same. And I would have to believe that the editors of the mainstream media know what we know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
they do.
Right. So then what these bastards are doing is they are purposely covering this up. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it would have to be, right? I mean, they're not stupid, right?
Right. But, you know, it's kind of interesting to me, and I'm getting a different feel for it lately. They have covered it up, yeah, for decades and decades, but it's getting out from under them. You know, like these bombings in Gaza are so in your face. I think they're telling people, we're going to do this, and you're not going to do anything about it.
Yes, I agree with you 100%.
Because of the weaponry they have, and the missiles, and the submarines, and they have made that statement. Martin Kreveld, major military historian in Israel, made the statement, we've got the weapons, and we can train them on European cities.
That's right.
What are you going to do about it?
Then they wonder why they're hated. It's so easy to hate them. Look, if any of the listeners really want to hate them even more, just pick up this book because you will entirely loathe them. You will despise them to your core. If you've built up a good level of hatred for them, you're not going to be born and hate anybody. You're not going to be born and go, I hate the Jews. You know,
right.
Why? Because I just hate the Jews. No, you're going to learn about the Jews and you're going to learn what they do and what they continue to do. So I've always been fascinated with this mainstream media thing.
Mm-hmm.
So these editors are part of the problem.
Oh, absolutely.
These are Americans.
Yeah, a lot of Gentile Americans work for these people.
The Gentiles can't get it past the Jewish editor gatekeeper anyway. So,
no.
So the blame has to go to the Jewish editor gatekeeper, right?
Yeah. What's interesting to me and what I've seen when I worked in D.C. is that the human capacity to deny reality and spin it and rationalize things is incredible if there's enough money in it for you. You know, they're going to minimize it. Oh, excessive response. That's one of the phrases. There's right. no excessive response. They're just wiping these people off the map.
Right, like the word incursion that you...
Mm-hmm. Incursion. Right. The full-fledged military assault on largely unarmed civilians, the handful of kids with rocks and some guys with some guns, against F-16s and tanks.
What a joke that you and I have paid for.
And we are paid $1 trillion to keep this little enterprise going.
As far as I'm concerned, mm-hmm. they're traitors and they need to be hung. They're not Americans. They're anti-American. And if somebody's pro-American, then I think you would have to be anti-Israel and vice versa, because it does not make any sense. These people will sell their soul out for money, like you said. Mm-hmm. It's all about money. They don't care about the Jews. They don't care about Israel. They care about their positions getting reelected over the children who are being massacred.
Absolutely.
In that fake country.
Mm-hmm. The thing about it, too, is the media has created a mindset, a culture, or an atmosphere of such fear of criticizing Israel / the Jews / you know, anywhere you go with it, you're an anti-Semite. California has passed a law. If you criticize Israel, you're an anti-Semite.
I saw that.
That's where we are. People are scared.
I'm not scared. Are you scared?
Sometimes. I'm really terrified at what America is becoming. It's weird. It's totally weird.
We're on the front lines of it. That's why.
Yeah, right. Because, and most people aren't seeing it.
That's it. Most people have no clue. And then when you try to explain it to them, they think you're from another planet, which you might as well be from another planet, because that's the way you feel most of the time. Because when you see this stuff, then nobody pays it. I've said it before plenty of times. I haven't watched TV in over 20 years, and I'm proud of it. First of all, I don't have any time. Why am I going to watch TV?
Right.
What a complete and absolute waste that is. That's like the president of the United States playing golf. If I was a president of the United States, knowing what I know about the shape of this country, I don't think I could play golf
really?
In good conscience.
People just don't think. That television, I think it destroys your mind. I mean, even the mechanism and the constant pictures and flickering imagery and voices telling you the same thing and coming at you and repetition after repetition just destroys people's minds.
I think you're right. I think that has a lot to do with it. I didn't always think that, but I really believe that the mainstream media, television included, is the main culprit in turning these people's minds into mush. They weren't really strong minds to begin with, but they really beat them down into like banana puree.
Mm-hmm.
On page 13, you talk about this guy, Mahmoud Abbas. Mahmoud, choking on some olives or hummus. You say here that Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinians, publicly deplores Palestinian violence, but does not bring up the fact that much greater violence on the part of the Israeli military preceded it. Now, Jennifer, I'm going to ask you, why would he do this? It doesn't make any sense. Why does he, as you say, parrot the Israeli line rather than presenting the facts of the situation and the viewpoint of his constituents? Why?
Why? You have to ask yourself. Because they'll take him out. I mean, they took out Yasser Arafat. He had some mysterious disease, Parkinson's, supposedly for years. He was kept in power. He was feeble. If you remember looking at his photographs in the last years of his life before he died or was assassinated, he was kind of pathetic.
That's what it must be. He's afraid.
He's terrified.
Because he knows he's got an F-16 or a drone hanging over his head. So instead of putting his head down and going, you know what, I can't do this to my own people.
Mm-hmm.
I will pretend that I'm here to help them.
Yeah.
Or instead of saying, you know what, no, I'm not going to do it. Kill me. No.
He's not big enough. That takes a big person. It takes a very big person. And they're not there. Nowhere in the world is that kind of leadership. Mm. And what goes on? Goes on and
that's
goes on.
Right.
They're all sold.
That's what it is.
Bought and sold.
And you say on the same page, this writer watched the statistics of casualties of the Palestinians and Israelis in the fall of 2001 for 2 months. And in every instance, Israeli violence against the Palestinians was committed in the occupied territories before the retaliatory violence of Palestinians.
Right. And it's the kind of violence. Shooting a young girl, 6 years old, writing her exam. Shooting a child, an infant, in its mother's arms. Shooting a young boy who stands up to stretch while doing his homework. He's up at the window. Shoot him in the head. Kill a young man going the day before his wedding. I mean, who does this stuff?
Jews. Israeli Jews. There's something wrong.
I mean, there's just, it's sick. The first time I was there, I was in Jabalia. It's so gross, these camps,
right.
These little death camps they keep them in. But these young boys were telling us how they made them stand in a cesspool all night long just because they could.
That's why I think there's something wrong mentally with these people.
Right.
These savages, these animals, these Israeli Jews, these Israeli/Jews, they don't care about anything other than the life of a Jew. And maybe it does have to do with their holy book.
Maybe it does.
Because it tells them that the non-Jew's life is worth less. Maybe they do actually believe that.
Well, that's a Talmud.
Right.
And that's what it teaches them. And it teaches them in detail. I mean, lots of advice how to deal with the world. And it's all negative.
On the chapter Childhood Lost, on page 47, you talk about a Palestinian non-governmental organization, Defense for Children. I found this fascinating when you said that, and again, this is on page 47, you said that that organization will not accept any money from American political or charitable groups because of the way the information is distorted by them.
Exactly.
That's incredible, because I'm sure that this NGO is dying for money, and then the U.S. doles out the most amount of money, but they will not take it. Do you think that these American political and charitable groups are infested and controlled by Israeli/Jews gatekeepers? Okay.
Absolutely. Because why don't any of them talk about this? The Red Cross has been there. The story of Jenin, and it was a village that was blown up years ago. It was kind of famous because they went in with the bulldozers, the Israelis did, and just bulldozed houses with people in them, with children in them, paraplegics in them. This insane, just genocidal frenzy. And they would not let the Red Cross in.
And the Red Cross didn't fight.
No.
There's something wrong with these Jews. There's something wrong with them. You don't bulldoze a house with people in it.
But they did. And they killed hundreds, and it was buried. The story was buried. What is fascinating is, why didn't the Red Cross demand? Where was their clout?
Because they are infested and controlled by Jewish gatekeepers, obviously.
Exactly.
Because if they're going to look at every life as important, they couldn't overlook this.
Exactly.
Page 48. In the 4 years of the Intifada, I think that means uprising.
Right.
Which was obviously precipitated by this preacher Jerome's visit to some Muslim holy place, I think it was.
Right, it was the Al-Aqsa.
676 Palestinian children have been killed. But the first Intifada, maybe that was in the 90s.
The first one is 89-90, yeah.
In the 4 years of the Intifada, 676 Palestinian children have been killed. And you say here the figure was most recent updated as of January 05. And of course, the book is based on your writings from that year, 05. These people think nothing, not just of killing an adult, but they kill children all the time. And because you say on that same page that not only has a violence against children not abated, the cause of death would indicate that the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, they're becoming increasingly violent. You say that injuries to the head and chest number 70% of the injuries inflicted on children in the occupied territory. So they're not shooting for the foot or the leg.
No, they're not deterring them. They're gunning them down. There was a, I can't remember the exact year, but it was a t-shirt, and it was a joke in the Israeli, shoot one, get two, targeting pregnant women.
I remember that.
Yeah.
A couple of years back, right? Maybe 2 years ago. I remember that. Yeah. Again, there's something wrong with them. There's got to be. This isn't normal.
No, it isn't. It isn't. You don't have to settle your differences. But they created the situation to begin with, and they've got them trapped. So what are the Palestinians supposed to do? I mean, a long time ago, I would say, well, they could just leave. But they're poor. They're dirt poor. In 1 year of the invasion, they called the incursion, this was in 2000, the Israelis destroyed a year's worth of the Palestinians' GDP. So what were they supposed to do?
They can't do anything.
They can't.
They're prisoners.
They're prisoners, and that world watches this and is so sick while blaming them. Oof.
I know how to take care of the problem.
Okay.
And it would not hurt anybody.
Okay.
Every person that has a boat, any size, in the world, break the Gaza blockade. They cannot stop every ship and boat in the world.
No, they can't.
They would be done. A huge number of boats, numbering in the thousands, all at once, would go to Gaza.
It'd be incredible if people could really get angry enough to throw this off. There's the weaponry, no doubt, and the money. But it's still a tiny clique controlling everybody. So strange. And, you know, my cynical interpretation of the Palestinian situation is that they are a hostage population. And they may even control politicians in the Western countries by saying, okay, you send us such and such and such and such. Or, for instance, in this last bombing of Gaza, 170 Palestinians were killed, over 900 wounded. Many of those would wind up as death figures eventually, because, of course, the medicine there is terrible.
Right.
But our so-called peacenik, Muslim-friendly president sent Israel $300 million for more military hardware. Maybe he was told, okay, we're going to blow up this place for another month, so where's the money? But even that's crazy, because they control the money. So what is it?
I think it's what you said before, that they're going into these poor people's areas where they live in complete desperation and poverty mm-hmm. and misery, mm-hmm. and they're showing the world that they can do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. If there were a critical mass of good Jews out there, then this wouldn't happen.
Exactly.
Then the Jews would say, enough's enough.
Exactly.
Look what you're doing to these people.
Quit it.
Right. Quit it now. No, let's give them more money. You're not even from there. You're not even from that area.
Yeah. You don't even live there.
You don't live there. You're from Lithuania or Poland or Germany or Ukraine. You're not from the Middle East. It's not your land.
It's not their land. But even if it were...
Even if it were, you don't do that to people.
Exactly. And they don't need it.
They don't need anything.
They live in New York. They're richest Croesus. They don't need it.
It cuts right through everything and right to the core. I didn't know what I was going to expect from reading your book. I never read anything that you wrote before.
Okay.
But the way that you write, it like just brought me in right away. And I read 60 pages in no time. I was just like... I got to read this. I got to learn about it. Even though this stuff is, I guess, available, it's not put in a concise manner that you have.
Right. Because the way it seeps out and it's intentionally done, people seem to understand what, yeah, there's violence on both sides. That's the old cycle of violence spin. That's not it.
Right.
That's another deception.
Yes, but
another
it works.
Way of hiding the reality. And yes, it does work.
Right. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Not a conflict.
Right.
It's a genocide of the Palestinian people.
Exactly. And I just interviewed an Israeli not too long ago. Great guy. Terrific guy. I really enjoyed the interview. And he came over from Argentina. He made what they call Aliyah, or however you say it, which is their return there. And he joined the IDF. He got injured. And he realized that the idea of Israel wasn't what his father had told him it was. And he became an activist. And he has built.
Good for him.
Yeah, absolutely. He has built for the Palestinians so far since 97, when they created this organization to rebuild the homes on the 30th anniversary of the occupation from their Six-Day War. He created an organization that has already built since 97 over 1,000 homes for Palestinians.
Good for him.
Because what they do is, and this is very interesting, this is the way that they do it, is it's all about the birth rate, because the Palestinians are producing a lot more children than the Jews are, not the Orthodox, those freaks that don't work.
Yeah, they have big families, yeah.
Yeah, well, those freaks that don't work and are supported by taxpayers. Here in the United States, the same thing. I don't know how they do it. No, we're studying our book. What? What are you talking about? You're studying your book. How are you contributing to society?
We're studying our book.
Right. That's anti-Semitic. You know, what they do is... Palestinians have a big family, and you know you were there. They can't live in the little Flintstone-type homes that they're living in, rock homes with no doors. They have to expand, so they have to build another home. Well, the Jews in Israel don't give them the licenses, the permits to build, so they end up building illegally, and then they get the demolition order, and they come in and they knock down the home.
It's a legal trap. It's the same thinking. Hate speech in America. If you criticize the Jews or you criticize Israel, you're a hater. You never get to the subject of the conversation this way.
All right.
Okay, they built their homes illegally. Where are they going to live? They won't let them build homes.
That doesn't matter. You're a hater.
Exactly.
You're a hater. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, and I guess that's like their version of the Red Cross. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, the total number of deaths of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza from September till the 2nd of February, and this was in 2005, 3,576. But as you point out, they don't include the 288 innocent bystanders or the 181 persons targeted as part of Israel's assassination program for Palestinians they call terrorists.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They give somebody a label, they discredit them, and they don't exist anymore. They have no value. And when you look at these terrorists, I remember this going to Ramallah and going into that town and just seeing these little photos of the, they call them martyrs because they are martyrs. They're little boys. They're little 13, 14, 16-year-old boys with peach fuzz. And these are the terrorists. coming up against a military super state with some rusty rifles.
If that, some rocks. And then you say here that the figure of Palestinian dead is nearly 6 times that of the Israeli civilian death. But again, mm-hmm. the mainstream media, when one Jew dies, they put it over and over over again. Because a Jew's life is worth more than a non-Jew's life, right?
Right.
You know that, right?
Because the Jew has personality, they have a family, they have a story. Palestinians are shadows. They're terrorists. You don't know them. They're all bad.
On page 59, 2,500 of the wounded among Palestinians are permanently disabled. Of wounded Palestinians, 36% are children. Mm-hmm. And over 85% of those children were under the age of 10. Mm-hmm. 21 infants under the age of 12 months mm-hmm. have been killed by the IDF or settlers. No less than 82 Palestinian children were killed before a single Israeli child lost its life.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Why do they keep at these people like this? Because eventually they've got to respond.
What we're talking about here is obviously this little country, which is now referred to as Israel, which is bordered by Egypt, the, I guess, what they call the Sinai, and then Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon.
Right.
And within this tiny little country, there are enclaves where the Palestinians are allowed to exist.
Right. That's a fair description. The picture that Americans have is kind of hard to understand because it's never really been carefully explained to them what the situation actually is. And one of the core weird beliefs that Americans have is that the Palestinians came out of the desert and attacked this little innocent state of Israel. And that, to begin with, is completely distorted. Palestine was full of Palestinians. And what now comprises the country of Israel was once Palestine. It was the Palestinian Mandate under the British, and that was only really very few years. And then it was controlled by the Ottoman Empire before that, but it was always lived in by the Palestinians. And the world powers, through the UN, divided the country up. When the Jews were moving into it, the Zionist Jews were moving into it in the 20s and 30s. In 1948, they divided it up, giving them the preferable part, that on the coast, the fertile land, and 54%. The Zionist Jews, who had largely arrived in the 2 decades before that, were still only 30% of the population. To try to draw an analogy for Americans, supposing, and it may happen, powers that be cut this country in half at the Mississippi, say, and gave the whole eastern half of this country to Mexico. What would Americans do? They'd go completely ballistic. Well, that's what actually happened to the Palestinians. They just gave their country away. Since then, in 1967, the Israelis, through warfare, took another 25%, bringing them up to 80%. And now they're even encroaching on that tiny little portion that the Palestinians have in the West Bank and on the Gaza Strip, and carving that up through the wall, through the use of military occupation, through checkpoints, and in military installations. If you look at a map, if you look at the map in my book carefully and really look at it, you will see that this thing called the West Bank has 671 checkpoints. That was the number in, I think, 2004. It may be a little less, a little more. The point still stands. You can't travel on the West Bank as a Palestinian without being stopped every 20 or 30 miles. And the police come on board the bus or get everybody out of the car, check the trunk. If you're delivering food, they take it all out in the sun. It sits there for hours. You know, they're looking for weapons. That kind of harassment. But then, in addition, there's this wall. It actually cuts the West Bank in half. People don't understand that. It also cuts into the West Bank on the westernmost side, that is close to Israel, and siphons off a lot of the water aquifer. It also carves up the land so it separates cities from farmland. Now, in addition to that, there are these 3 major highways that traverse it horizontally so that Israeli tanks, jeeps, etc. can move back and forth between Israel and the Jordan River, which defines the easternmost side of the West Bank. And that's all militarized. So if a Palestinian got a notion he was going to leave, he would be trapped between a rock and a hard place, between the military on the Israeli side, between this highly militarized zone on the eastern side, beyond which is desert, true desert. And then inside the wall itself, every couple hundred yards has a tower. It's a military tower. So they've got guns with scopes and watching these people all the time. And there's more to it than that. But just try to give people an idea what is supposed to become the Palestinian state. And that's this completely militarily controlled West Bank and the Gaza, which is another situation that they just bomb at will. The control is exercised in other ways as well. There are on the West Bank some 1,500 military orders. Because it's an occupied zone, there is no civil law. These people are just subject to arbitrary arrest, detention with no charges, held for weeks, months, tortured, and some 40% of the male population on the West Bank has been subjected to this. That's pretty incomprehensible.
The whole thing is incomprehensible. I just want to ask you about a couple of, more than a couple of things in the book. But you talked about the West Bank and Gaza, or the Gaza Strip, which is in the southwest corner of this country they call Israel, which I guess a lot of listeners probably realize the Jews that are there actually don't have any genetic connection to that part of the world. These Jews, these Zionist Jews, these Ashkenazi Jews are not from Israel or biblical Israel. They're from Lithuania and Poland and Germany and Ukraine.
There are some who have old blood from that part of the world. Some 90% are Ashkenazi. They originally are from Central Asia, and then they moved west into Europe.
Right.
But yeah, they make up the majority of the population there.
Right. I think Ashkenazi Jews in the world are like 98% of all the Jews in the world. So it's a lot of Ashkenazi Jews. But these guys, like you said, they're not from there, but somehow they live under this illusion that they are from there and perpetuate this illusion. But this is the really disturbing part of this whole matter, is that I can't figure out how a group of people, the Jews in Israel, which really shouldn't even be called Israel because it's Palestine, how these people can mentally bring themselves to commit these abuses over decades and how very few of them are actually opposing it. The Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, can go about shooting people for nothing, for hanging up their laundry, as I read in your book, or playing soccer in front of their house, for nothing, for sitting on their mother's lap, like that four-year-old girl who got shot in the head for no reason. They can do that every day. They can erect these monstrous walls, as you described over and over in the book, with these watchtowers that are manned with no men, but remote-controlled machine guns.
That was going to be in the Gaza. Many of them have soldiers in them.
There's guns pointed at civilians for no reason, 24/7.
Right.
And these Jews want you to feel sorry for them because of a Holocaust that never existed because there's absolutely zero forensic evidence. But these are the real Nazis of today?
Yeah. That's what we're told, day and night. That's why people stay away from it. I mean, that's the core reason that nobody will ever touch the Palestinian story or go near it. They know it's not safe. And as far as the behavior of the Israelis / Jews / Zionists out there, I mean, I've heard preposterous stories like they don't know this goes on. I mean, how can they not? They're doing it. And right now, there was a picture, one of these graphic things, the bombing of Gaza. These little girls writing on bombs, you know, writing death to the Palestinians, whatever, or this one's a gift for me. So 80% of that population believes that, yeah, they have to keep up the pressure on the Palestinians. So I don't know. I can't get into the inside of somebody's mind, particularly people that act this irrationally cruel.
You really said it perfectly. How they can act irrationally, well, what's rational, but how they can act this cruel continually for decades and not seem to be bothered about it in the least. Yeah, there are some Jews that live there, obviously, that are helping the Palestinians. And that's another thing that I don't get. I don't understand how they're able to exist, because the way you describe it in the book, there's a couple of main factors here that are impinging on the Palestinians having a normal existence. It would be the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the food.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not really important.
Right.
And the employment. Also, their psychological health, living in a war zone.
where they live in this desert prison camp has been turned into that, partially. The West Bank was always drier. It's away from the ocean, and when you're in the Middle East and you keep going further, you keep getting drier. That's kind of obvious. But that was done intentionally. They drill, the Israelis actually drill into the deep wells and suck out the water that the Palestinians always used to irrigate that part of the world, which is semi-arid. Despite that, they were exporting food as recently as 1967. That's been destroyed. The homes. There is a concerted program that's been in place since 1948, the Absentee Property Owners Law. And the law says, basically, if you're not here, we get your property. Well, they drove them off in 1948. They drove them off again in 1967. And that's why 30% of the population of the West Bank are refugees from what is now called Israel. And fully 80% of the people in Gaza are refugees from what is now called Israel. Obviously, the overcrowding is incredible, particularly in Gaza. But the Israelis have either claimed or destroyed some 150,000 Palestinian homes in Israel. And then they, within the state, don't allow them to build with all these kind of harassment laws. And on the West Bank, they still occupy them or bulldoze them. I talked to people whose homes had just been stolen. I mean, they were living in tents because the Israelis just moved in and moved them out. But this goes on en masse, and the state justifies it, you know, through these laws. The funny thing is, like, later they knew this law looked bad, so they claim that they don't just arbitrarily take land, but they allow some private corporation out to do that. In fact, the same thing goes on. The theft of the land, the theft of water. 85% of the water on the West Bank for the settlements or for Israel. I mean, they have swimming pools in the settlements. They have shopping malls in the settlements. They have hot showers in the settlements. And outside the Palestinians, about 20% of the water available to the settlements is available to the Palestinians. It's less than the World Health Organization says is necessary to maintain your health, maintain your life. So how do people live like this? It's amazing how far down you can go before you expire.
And you mentioned the other part of it. I mentioned the shelter, the food, the water, and the employment. But the other part of it, of course, is what you mentioned with the settlers who grab the high ground and then get everything, including, like you said, swimming pools. And these people don't even have enough water or quality water to drink. I feel guilty just having what I have, and I don't have much at all. But I know that there are people, even in the state that I live, probably in the town that I live, who are hungry, who don't have enough to eat. Right. Fortunately, I don't have that problem. But how could these people live like they do on a hill in a swimming pool with green lawns, knowing that below them is basically Fred Flintstoneville or Bedrock, which was the town that Fred Flintstone lived in?
Well, I mean, that part of the world, traditionally, everything was built of stone. Why? Because there was a lot of stone. There are no trees, not like our world. I mean, it's semi-arid. It's a whole different kind of flora. But it's that these little houses that they had have not been, I mean, they've been destroyed or half destroyed. They have very little of the basics that you consider part of modern life. Electricity, running water. In the middle of summer, the water just dries up. The month of August, no water. And then, of course, the employment, they did used to work in Israel for, I don't know, a third to half of what the lowest level employment paid in Israel. But now they can't even do that. They've been shoveled off to the West Bank. They can't go and seek employment. So what do they have to do? Well, they have a few little industries. They have a little agriculture. They try to get by, you know, and that's employment. But even that, I was talking to a doctor in Ramallah. He would have to go through the checkpoint every day to get to the hospital, which was in Bethlehem, but you had to go through this checkpoint, or else you have to go around for hours and hours in the hills. And, you know, they drive around these little rickety things. But how many days in his life was he not able to get to work or got there late so the patient died? That aspect of it, people don't think of that. Or kids that spend an hour, 2 hours every day before they can get to school, so they're always late. And then they go through the same thing on the way back. And they just around these checkpoints, and they go through their crayons and their pencils, make sure there are no AK-47s in their book bags. It's kind of ridiculous. There's one little village I was in. It had a military installation and two checkpoints. This is a couple hundred people.
Infuriating would be too mild of a term. On page 24, about the Israeli settlements, they're invariably built on high land, heavily protected by barbed wire, electric fences, and sometimes mines in the surrounding area. They're conjoined by roads designated for Jews only. No, Jews aren't racist. No. They're not racist. And that's anti-Semitism, listeners. Roads designated for Jews only. Superhighways as compared to the winding, narrow roads allowed the Palestinians. It is illegal for a Palestinian to cross one of these, and this is in quotes, Jews-only roads. Do they have signs that says Jews-only?
Yeah.
And they're in Hebrew, English, and then in Arabic.
That's all the signs on the West Bank are in those three languages, which is interesting. Hebrew, English, and then Arabic. Maybe it should be the reverse, maybe.
Yeah, that makes sense. Page 25, there are 671 roadblocks and checkpoints spread across the area. And I guess this is what we're talking about, parts of the West Bank. 671 roadblocks and checkpoints in their own land.
What's left of it, right. But even when they got this so-called 20%, they settled for 20%. At that point, the Israelis still had direct control over 30% of the land on the West Bank. And then they shared control with another 20 or 30% of it with the Palestinians. So the Palestinians, even then, only had direct control over 20% of the land. But what does that mean, really? If you're surrounded by military and you don't control most of the land and you don't control the good highway system and you don't have a military, well, you don't even have water or much to eat, what do you control? It's meaningless. You know, even when I think about being so detailed and trying to describe this to people, it's really meaningless.
Yeah. It's also insidious.
Mm-hmm. Because it keeps on keeping on. They can keep encroaching this way, slowly over time. I think that another aspect of this that Americans don't think about is how so much that's been pioneered, if that's the right word, on the West Bank and Gaza is now working or functioning in America. For instance, the strip machine that was pioneered in Gaza, we now have in the airport. Control over electronic communications. They're spying. They can spy on any exchange that goes on in the West Bank. Well, that's being brought in here. It's a bigger country. There's a lot of millions of people mouthing off all the time. A little harder, but the concept is there, as well as a lot of the technology to control people. You could look at it as a big testing ground for the super police state.
Now, there was an article in Reuters a couple weeks ago about that exact thing that you're talking about here, that it's proven ground for these weapons. And it has been for decades.
Yeah. Phosphorus bombs that were used in Palestine in 2008-09. And also another bomb that people don't know anything about. It's called the DIME. It's Dense Inert Materials Explosive. I saw pictures of what this bomb did to the human body. It's incomprehensible. But there were like bodies that melted, where the head melted away.
What's wrong with these Jews?
I don't know. It's real crazy because for years, there was a Jewish population in Palestine. It was about 8%, small. They got along with each other, but they too, now those, you know, Sephardic Jews, whatever, are part of this. To say they were badly treated, you know, they're victims, supposedly. But to turn around and do this to people never did anything to them. In the 30s and 40s, the Palestinians were begging the world community, saying, what are you doing? But no one would listen, any more than they do now.
Well, fortunately, there's been a significant backlash against the Israeli government because of their latest slaughter against the Gazans. I've been reading a lot about how countries are basically giving them the finger. What's wrong with these Jews? Do you think that it's the inbreeding? Because that's a fact that obviously if you were an Ashkenazi woman and I was an Ashkenazi man and we wanted to get married, we'd have to take these specific genetic tests because there are, I think, over 20 genetic diseases you could get just from breeding. And the reason is because of inbreeding. Do you think that mentally there's something wrong with these people?
Possibly it's genetic at root, but it's also attitudinal, and they kind of work together, it would seem. I mean, they're very in-group tight, trying to exclude others, but they also get this from the rabbis and in their culture, distrust and hatred for other people. So it's really hard to know how this got this virulent.
Right. They're ugly. They are ugly people. They're ugly for what they do to these poor Palestinians who were there before them and did nothing for them. I just want to read some more. Page 29. Travel on a Palestinian road takes anywhere from 2 to 4 times as long as on the Jew roads, the Jew-only roads. When they have to go through these checkpoints, if they want to sell their food, which obviously will spoil after this, and it does, the wait is often 2 or 3 days. Days!
Yeah. Well, so that's intended to destroy the produce.
But again, it gets back to what is wrong with these Jews. There's something wrong with these Jews. To do this, to continually do this to a group of people is not normal. It's not human. That's why there are laws against this. They're violating, like you said in the book, I think something like 68 laws.
68 violations, yeah, according to the UN of international law, the way they treat Palestinians. That's standing at this point. Or in the last couple of years. But if you go, and I went to the Gaza in 1989-90, that's 22 years ago. You couldn't get in when I went there in 2005. In 2009, some kids snuck in, had to be a teenager, got to run fast. So I didn't go then, but I did see it way back when. I was horrified. I couldn't even comprehend the way these people lived in these little stone huts, you know, 2, 3, 4 square foot rooms, sewage running down the street, no infrastructure, no electricity, a bulb hanging, no running water or running every now and then. Incredible. No heat. Places that they were put in 1948, you know, that you think, God, could people get through a season in this? Here we are, 75 years later, and they're still there, and they're being bombed with the most sophisticated technology. For instance, in 2012, the bombing campaign on Gaza by the Israelis, they were using drones. And I was listening to this young boy, little English boy, little heroic child that was over there. And he was running his own internet TV thing. And he would leave it and put it on the sound open. So you could hear what he heard. And it was the sound of drones. It's an incredible sound. It's a drone. Literally that, this droning sound would just drive you insane because it never stops. And they keep sending these things. In addition to F-16s, you could hear the bombs dropping in the distance and dogs howling. And then they'd stop.
Another weapon created by the Jews, just like the truck bomb was created by the Jews. Now, one of the things you pointed out was how, again, insidious is a perfect word for what these Jews have done and continue to do, because what they did, specifically in the Gaza, was that they basically incorporated the Gazan economy into the Israeli economy over the course of over 40 years, and then they turned off the spigot.
Exactly.
Did I miss anything, or is that kind
of... That's it. They shoved all these people in there. A little strip of land, about 20 miles long. Not much you can grow on it. It's almost desert, but they do. They manage gardens. But most of them would go into Israel to work because there were no jobs there, because they really weren't allowed to develop an economy of any kind. Then in 2005, the pulling out the settlers were very few in number compared to the Gazans, and then cutting them off, isolating them from the world.
I want to talk about these settlers, these bastards that have these U.S. weapons, these automatic weapons that are used to kill Palestinian children.
The word settler gives you the idea you've got a little settlement with three families in Arkansas in 1825. You know, no, these are huge cities with like 100,000 people in them. As of 2006, the population was 450,000 Israeli settlers on the West Bank. It has only gotten larger. Because every single settlement they start to build out, they get okayed and approved by their own government and ours. I mean, it's a takeover. It's an ongoing takeover. And let the people below them starve to death.
Right, while they bulldoze their homes.
Right.
You say here on page 67, some villages also receive the wastewater from the settlements, which runs into agricultural land. So what the Jews have done there is, and you mentioned this before, they control all the water and they dole it out. Sometimes they don't even give these Palestinians water. As you say on page 67, that settlements use 5 times the amount of water than the Palestinians do.
Mm-hmm.
5 times.
Five times.
Israeli settlers alone have killed 59, and there's more now, but 59 Palestinians in 2000.
That was in 2005, way up, because of the bombings now. That was just gunning them down.
Right. That's just like me going out into my front yard and killing a neighbor who lives down the hill.
Exactly. Yeah, because he annoys you, so you just kill him.
Just because I could. And the other thing that we didn't mention was the agriculture, which was a huge part of the Palestinians for centuries and centuries and centuries, maybe millennia, were the olive trees and the grape trees.
Mm-hmm.
Every day I read about these settlers chopping down these olive trees.
And you know what's interesting? Another aspect of this, of course, is they rip them out, and that creates erosion, or it adds to the problem of erosion. Roots help, and water help pack the land down. So they just continue to desertify the West Bank. And then these trees wind up in their farms or in Israel proper. Olive trees are last centuries. There are trees in the Garden of Gethsemane that were there at the time of Christ. They are just a very long-lived tree. It has tremendous deep-rooted strength. But that's being destroyed because they are destroying the very record of an existence of the society.
And that's the plan.
And that's the plan.
On page 110, you were talking about the Jews pulling out of the Gaza Strip and how the settlers that were there, the small number of settlers, I think it was something like, if I remember, 7,500.
Compared to 1.2 million Palestinians living in Gaza.
Israel had asked the U.S. Congress, read taxpayers, and they know that, for $2.2 billion to leave Gaza. And then you say here, does it cost this much to rehouse these 7,500 illegal occupiers of land? Does it cost this much to put the tanks in reverse? Why does it cost this much? And why should the American public pay it anyway, as the settlers are not legally entitled to a dime?
Right.
How about when there's a wounded child who has to get medical care and the Jews won't let the ambulance get through the checkpoint?
Over 900 incidences of that in 2008. Attacking ambulances, attacking doctors, tending to the wounded in the street.
55 Palestinian women have given birth at Israeli checkpoints, 20 of whom lost their babies. This is on page 88.
I was told a story. Here's another story. This was in the city of Nablus. According to the Israelis, Nablus is a hotbed of Islamic terrorism. But anyway, this man was taking his wife to the hospital. She was about to give birth. They had to go through the checkpoint. The Israeli soldiers stopped them and detained them indefinitely. And they waited and they waited. Finally, hours later, they were allowed through. Her water had broken in the meantime, and they got to the hospital. It was a stillbirth, because of being detained and not getting any medical care. So the next day, they turned around, they were driving back, and they were stopped at the checkpoint one more time. And the soldier said, "Open that box," thinking, of course, it's a bomb. They opened it. It's the dead baby's body.
Unbelievable. I like how you called them inmates in Gaza. Page 108, the inmates of Gaza have been paying some of the highest electricity rates in the world, despite the fact that 80% of them are living on $1.60 per day or less.
How do people live like this? They live out of a garden. And I asked somebody I knew who was from Gaza, but his family left decades ago. They said, "Well, you don't have to eat every day."
Wow. You say here on page 109, thousands of Palestinians had not seen family members since the closure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Page 113, the basic food package, because these people are not allowed to grow their own food. They have to get permits to do everything, like you explained. Permits to get married to a certain person. They have to get permits to travel in their own land, where everything they do is through a permit.
If a Israeli Arab marries somebody from the occupied territories, they can't live in Israel, because somebody from the occupied territories is automatically a terrorist.
The basic food package of flour, rice, oil, sugar, and milk hardly provides for an adequate diet, especially for growing children and pregnant women. Total food consumption from 2000 to 2005 has fallen by one-third.
On the West Bank, because that was the years of the incursions and the destruction of the West Bank that destroyed this $1 billion worth of infrastructure on the West Bank, whatever was left of it. Food has always been, of course, a way to control a population through food and water.
More than 50% of the children in Gaza are anemic.
Right. Well, I told that story about the Italian researcher who went there and he looked at a glass of water.
I want to get to that now. Thank you.
Fecal matter, worms. This is what they drink. Well, of course, they're anemic. I mean, the water's toxic. They're not chowing down on burgers. Kids aren't getting nourishment.
Were you in Gaza, too?
I was in Gaza in 89-90, and that was enough to terrify me. I thought, oh, my God. And this is 22 years ago. This is before all this stuff happened. Absolute CRAP. Disgusting.
You could say crap.
Horrible. I mean, just horrible. Yeah, I mean, it's crap running in the streets.
Right.
Little stone houses, no nothing, hovering in the cold. But this was before they intentionally destroyed the water supply, which is also done. The Israelis did that in Gaza, and that's why it wound up like that. Palestinians are the largest group and the oldest group of refugees in the world, and nobody does anything or even talk about it.
77% of the population, this is page 107, that is 1 million people live in poverty. At least 23% live in deep poverty, which means that even after they receive the aid from these international agencies, they don't rise above the poverty line.
Right. And it's getting worse, worse and worse. Actually, UNRWA cut aid, and I can't remember the year, but I think it was 2004. Half the population in Gaza was dependent on UNRWA just to keep them going, and they actually cut aid. They cut back a little more and a little more and a little more.
Unbelievable. And then you were talking about how they were talking about creating some kind of a road or tunnel from southern part of the West Bank to the Gaza Strip. And then you say here on page 111, what difference will it make if the Israelis occasionally allow the Palestinians to scurry back and forth between prison camps? And that's exactly what they are. They're prison camps. They're living in prison camps.
Right, exactly.
That basically sums up what we're trying to say here. These are prison camps. Mm-hmm.
There were prison camps in the gulags in the Soviet Union, run by the same people, by the way. Lenin's dead. Untold story. Yeah, these are prison camps. I went to refugee camps. I got inside these people's homes. It's got a cement floor. It's like a garage. It's cold. It's about 6 feet long and 8 feet wide. There were two parents and four kids at that point living in this. They slept on the floor on blankets. I mean, in the winter, there's no heat. In summer, it's an oven. And, you know, the kids were so cute. They said, well, won't you stay with us overnight? And,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's amazing how resilient they are.
I could never survive one night.
No, of course not. It's amazing how resilient these people are.
I know.
And they're kind, like you said, that you were warned about, and this is on page 89, you were warned about how, you know, you got to be careful. Don't show your money there. And you actually made a point of showing your money and that you left a camera on a table for a couple hours. Nothing happened to it. And these people were actually lending you money.
Yeah. I mean, that's a funny story. That was in Jordan. They were Palestinians. Though. I mean, there's another weird thing that happens, how long it takes to communicate with a bank and to get my money through. They were used to that. They said, oh, don't worry, you can stay with us. It'll come through eventually. And it did, but I stayed in their house. That was when my visa was up and I had to get out. I was not going to be breaking the law there.
These are the people that have the empathy. These are the people that know suffering, not the Jews. The Jews don't know suffering. And I wanted to mention about the prison camps, and I was saying that sums up basically what we're talking about here, that these people are living in prison camps much, 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 much worse than the so-called concentration camps. The water, you mentioned the raw sewage, page 114, floating in the open sewers of the prison camp and eventually finding its way into the water table. You talk about tiny worms floating in the water, and you mentioned that doctor from Italy who measured the level of nitrate that was so high that the water could be used as a pesticide, and that the lead content was astronomical, three times the amount considered safe by the World Health Organization, and that 4 out of 5 of these poor children in these prison camp had parasites, and 60% of them suffered from anemia. Not only are they destroying them with their weapons, the constant drone, as you said, of the drones, with the constant surveillance, with the constant necessity to get a permit. And you say 20 people live in the father's 3-room house. This fella's a meager income supports all of them. He says, we are watched all the time and we are not allowed to speak. Is that work? He has to ask permission to go to the restroom and eat his lunch where he sits. If he is ill, he is not allowed to leave. The checkpoint only opens to allow the workers in and out.
Prison work camp.
Prison work camp. Exactly. These Jews are much worse than the Nazis ever could have imagined to be. The Nazis were civilized compared to these Jews.
And whatever they did in 2 years' time.
Exactly.
This has gone on for decades. No sign of change.
On page 119. At the height of the Israeli incursions in May 2001, the head of the Brazil Community Health Program made the following statement. Every single person in Gaza is traumatized, including myself. The most traumatized are the children. They have lost their world of security. They live in a cage with no roof and receive trauma from the sky when Israeli helicopters and planes bomb Palestinian locations and from the eyes of their parents. Some people are in a state of panic. Every family has at least one member who is a bedwetter. There's a little bit more, but I want to ask you this. I know you were there in 89-90. Were you traumatized like this fellow was?
Not like he was, because the bombing hadn't started yet. But I was traumatized by what I saw. I was really shocked. It was at Christmas time, and I remember going back. I came back from the trip to Jabalia and just sat there, just stunned. You know, oh my God. And that's when I decided to go back. I mean, it's kind of, I don't say getting hooked, but I was, because, I mean, there's nothing like that in this country. I wish people would understand that we support this, and it's our money that's being used to do this, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
It's the American taxpayer that pays for this.
They're paying for something they don't even know what it is they're paying for.
Exactly.
We mentioned the shelter, the food, the water, the employment, and the settlers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the checkpoint, the wall, all the ways that the Jews are dehumanizing and destroying the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
But I failed to mention the prisons.
Mm-hmm.
On page 45, Palestinian political prisoners who are in Israeli jails and prisons, they number about 8,000.
That was the number then. It's probably back up at this point. It goes down, they let a few out, they bring the population back up. But at the time that the one Israeli soldier was taken by Hamas, there were 10,000 Palestinians in prison. There you go. One versus 10,000.
The adult who are being thrown into prisons, but as you say on page 47, more than 3,000 children have been arrested during the last 4 years from when you wrote the book. So they're violating international laws. On page 61, you say here that 650,000 Palestinians have seen the inside of Israeli prisons since 1967. That amounts to 40% of the male population.
That's terrorizing a population. It's incomprehensible. They do this to kid. And I did a couple of different interviews with young boys who had been through this. I would really suggest people read those. I want to talk about one little incident, though. I mean, this kind of underscores my experience there, which was strange in the extreme. But I went to this organization, which you mentioned, actually, Defense for Children, because of the arrest of kids, the torture of kids, the shooting of kids, et cetera, et cetera. I got a CD and I was sitting because the room was so cold, my back against the radiator. I had it on my computer and it was the interviews with these kids about being beaten up, about being raped. One little boy and the grandfather was talking and he could barely get through the interview because this happened to the child. He was 11 or 12, but he was later released. I got the CD out of the country. It wasn't a CD, it was a DVD, but it had been electronically destroyed at the border, of course. But I did ask, I said, what happened to that little boy? And the man there at the organization told me he was shot a couple of years later. So, daily life.
I don't know how they do it. But to go to prison, here's some of the things that will allow you a trip inside one of these Nazi prisons. They're worse than the Nazis, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, they're much worse than Nazis.
Yeah.
Much worse than Nazis.
How long has this gone on? 75
right,
years.
Exactly. To go to jail, this will get you inside one of their Nazi prisons. Holding a Palestinian flag could earn you 6 months. Membership in an illegal organization, which of course the Jews defined what's legal and what's illegal, 9 months. A gathering of more than six people, 6 months. 1,600 military orders for the West Bank and 1,300 for Gaza control all aspects of life.
Right. Of course, those 1,300, now they're Gaza supposedly independent. Okay. So they're not under military rule. They're under military control.
Right. But as you mentioned in the book, that's the whole scam that you talked about was because they're really not allowed to do this because they're an occupying force, right?
Right. They break all the rules all the time.
Well, they're Jews. They suffered. They can do whatever
they want. They
suffer
their exception to every rule in the book.
Right. Well, I don't even think Jews are human anyway. These Jews that do this stuff to these people, they can't be human. How could you be human and shoot a child who's playing soccer in his front yard? Shoot a mother who's hanging up laundry in her backyard. How could you be human?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if it were the height of conflict or a real battle, I know the battle dehumanizes soldiers. It does. But this isn't battle. These are just these poor people trapped.
I know. On page 62, which I was just reading from about the military orders, I'm not going to read it because it would take too long, but listeners, you got to get to that page and take a look at the standard operating procedure that's employed by the IDF when making an arrest. You will not believe it.
But that's what I think they're betting on. People won't believe it.
Well, you were there. You saw it.
I saw it. Allison Weir has seen it. Lots of people that I met there saw it. Kids who get into the kind of various different ways. Religious people who live there. Some who travel back and forth. People within NGOs. Yeah, people have seen it. Our voices are minute compared to the ongoing propaganda.
No, that's exactly right.
And they're just hoping we will not be believed. Why I went to so much trouble to try to document it. I used a lot of Jewish sources so I wouldn't be questioned.
Did you take a lot of photos?
I did. I took a lot of photos. They're on the website.
What's the website?
HolyLandUnveiled.com. So there are more facts, more statistics, more photos.
The Holy Land Unveiled by Jennifer Dixon. Thank you for writing this book. Thank you for going there and sharing your experiences with me and everybody else who has the pleasure of reading this fine book.
Thank you.